Hey everyone, welcome to the Delta Flyers with Tom and Harry as we journey through episodes of Star Trek Voyager. Your two hosts along this journey are my fellow Voyager actor, and I've said it before, and today I will say it again, who portrayed the role of Milt Elliot in the 1994 TV movie One More Mountain, Mr. Robert Duncan McNeil, and myself, your favorite forever ensign, Garrett Wong. Remember, you can get the full version of this podcast by signing up to become a patron at patreon.com/TheDeltaFlyers.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Now, you're probably wondering, why am I keep
repeating? Why are you bringing up One More Mountain?
Because.
What is that? It looks like a fraternity shirt.
It is. It's Greek letters, but this is a gift from our Admiral Chris Knapp to me. And basically it says, eat me. Eat me in Greek letters. For those of you who are listening, it's a blue shirt with white lettering. It's basically Sigma Delta Tau, which is not, you know, but it's eat me. So it's Sigma Delta Tau Mu Sigma.
That was what I thought was my line in the one of my lines.
But it wasn't. Actually don't say that. But it's so humorous and it's so funny that. And also, Chris Knapp thinks it's so funny that he sent me this. And funny enough, when he sent it, it said it was delivered all the way to Canada. And for some reason, it was not delivered. It went to another address. So we had to wait even longer for him to send a second shirt.
Oh, my
gosh.
So
I've been waiting to wear this thing as a prop shirt to kind of, you know, make you laugh and our listeners and viewers laugh. And finally,
yes,
I'm able to do it. So now,
and for those that haven't heard the story, Milt Elliot, that character, was one of the cowboys in One More Mountain about the Donner Party that gets stranded, a true story.
Yes.
They were stranded in Donner Pass.
That's right.
It's now named Donner Pass because many of them died in that winter, the horrible winter, and they engaged in cannibalism to stay alive. They actually ate the people who died. And it's horrible. And so my character, really, as he was dying, said to Meredith Baxter Burney, please eat me. But I didn't say that.
You know, he actually said, please, something to the effect of use my body or something like that. Right.
Something like that.
But it's far funnier if your line was, please eat me. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So that's why I'm wearing this to commemorate that.
Thank you.
One credit of yours, which brings so much joy and happiness and laughter
to Chris Knapp.
Into Chris Knapp and many other people's lives, not just Chris.
Thank you.
So thank you, Chris Knapp, for the shirt. I have it. All right. So are we ready for this week's episode?
Let's dive in. Let's go watch it.
Let's go watch this episode.
Okay. This week's episode is
Muse. M-U-S-E, Muse.
Yes.
All right, everyone. We will be right back with our recap and discussion of Muse for all of our Patreon patrons. Please stay tuned for your bonus material. All right, everyone. We are back from watching Muse. My goodness.
Yes.
I did remember the basic plot.
Yeah.
The Greek chorus, you know, and the pre-warp society. I got that.
Yeah.
But I
actually really liked this episode. Like, I didn't... I sort of remembered some of it. It kind of came back.
Right.
I didn't have a ton to do. Neither one of us. You had more to do than me.
Well, later. I am happy that, you know, Paris didn't cause anything to happen in this episode.
Yes.
It wasn't Paris and Neelix
didn't
doing something
go make
weird.
A trade. We didn't cause the whole problem.
No. Yeah. So that's one plus in this episode. Yeah.
Let's start with our poetry.
Here we go.
Let's do it.
Mm-hmm. My haiku for Muse. Here we go.
Yes.
The flyer crash lands. Local poet helps Torres. Harry saves the day. Okay.
Nice.
All right. Let's hear your limerick.
All right.
Let's
here's my limerick synopsis. You know, I really like the poetry synopsis. Like, we used
They're
to
fun.
Try to
They're, you know
used to try our... to recap a quick thing, and it never was quick.
No, it meandered and it was long and it was just not just, efficient. It was so not Borg-like. And now
this is great.
This is very Borg-like right now. Okay,
all right,
go ahead.
Here we go with a limerick synopsis for Muse.
Lay it on me.
Some aliens put on a play. You probably won't see it on Broadway. It's the Voyager story, a TV writer allegory. With an inspired ending, B'Elanna saves the day.
Very nice, but don't make me laugh in the first verse. That doesn't, that's not fair. I had to hold that in the entire time. Like,
you probably
won't see it on Broadway. That was what a great line. Oh, I love that one. Very good. Very good. Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
And it is a writer's, a TV writer's allegory. The whole thing. Every time I heard the guy talking about, I need an ending. I need a surprise. I need a twist. I was like, this is all TV writer notes. Like,
I love it though,
crazy.
Right?
Yeah,
I mean, we don't have any type of episode like this at all.
No,
so
it's really.
I was pretty excited about this.
There was a lot of inside baseball metaphors about TV writers' lives.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Anyway, speaking of writers, written by Joe Manosky.
Yeah, I like that.
I feel like this is the perfect script for him too, because he's
really
always.
Is.
He always thinks like very classically, like the fact that he kind of, you know, deconstructed Greek drama and things like that. I love it. So Joe did a great job.
I feel like we need to kidnap him with ninjas and then we can interview him for our podcast because he doesn't want to do interviews.
He doesn't. He's introverted, reclusive, to a point.
I would say, you know, he doesn't need anyone around him. He's very self-sufficient.
Yep.
And he's very talented. And if you're in his office talking to him, he's a nice guy. You know, he'll talk to you. He's not like he's not going to say anything, but he will not do interviews. And I really feel like I need some type of angle to reach out to him. So
it's a challenge.
It is.
Okay. Right. Written by Joe Manosky, directed by Mike Vahar.
Mike came back to do another one for us. Okay.
I loved Mike Vahar. He
Me
was
too.
Awesome.
He was.
And we've talked about him before. So
We have.
Let's get into guest stars. We start with Kellis, who was the writer.
Okay.
That guy.
Yeah.
He, just the writer.
That guy.
The, you know, the Greek drama
the main
writer.
Poet. Yes,
yeah, basically. The poet, exactly. Yeah. Kellis. His very first job was not long before this, actually. He was, as premiered on Frasier, the sitcom Frasier in 1998. So just a couple years before us.
What's his name? You just said his character name.
Joseph Will.
Thank you.
Joseph Will is his name.
Joseph Will? Spell that. Spell Will.
W-I-L-L.
Just like a Will. Okay.
Just like a Will.
Exactly. All right, thank you. Thank you, Joseph.
He also, a little trivia, he had a speaking role in Star Trek The Experience, the Borg Invasion 4D attraction.
Oh my gosh, which I've been through multiple times. So
he was a chief security officer and he got Borgified and he had a line, some speaking role there, but he was in Star Trek The Experience. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Huh. So he's actually, he wasn't part of the actors that they hired to interact with the fans that were there.
No.
He was part of the actual part of the ride because they had the original ride. Then they added the Borg invasion one. That was the second ride that they had. Okay.
Yeah. Joseph Will was in that too. Mm-hmm. So that's cool.
Great.
Kelly Waymire played Lena, the actress and girlfriend of the writer.
Yes. The jealous girlfriend.
Yes. Kelly Waymire, I will say. She had a recurring role on Enterprise in the beginning of that show.
Oh.
But sad, very, very sad story about Kelly. She died of an undiagnosed cardiac arrhythmia, and she was only 36 years old when she died.
What?
So very sad, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Very sad. I thought Kelly did a great job in this episode. I'm so glad she was part of Voyager and just sad to share that news that she passed away at such a young age.
Definitely. But most of the times we talk about actors that have passed away, they're in their 70s, their 80s, their 90s, and now we have someone very young. That's
very young.
Tragic.
We had our Greek chorus. I'll talk about those guys. The first one was chorus number one is what he was called, Jack Axelrod.
Okay.
Jack Axelrod is now 92 years old. So speaking of Kelly dying so young, Jack is still alive. He's 92 years old.
Yeah.
His first job was in Kojak in 1977.
Kojak with Telly Savalas.
Telly Savalas.
That was the first. Okay. If you think about it, that's the first hairless star of a show, at least in our era, I suppose.
Yeah,
right.
That was very it was a signature thing.
That
he
was
the bald...
That was pre Patrick Stewart.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
and pre Bob Picardo, basically. Yeah. So yeah, to be the lead of a show and bald was very rare back then. So Telly Savalas did it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that was chorus number one, Jack Axelrod, 92 right. years old, still going strong.
Nice.
Chorus number two was John Shuck.
John Shuck.
No, okay. John Shuck is a theater actor. He played like, I think I saw him in Annie at some point.
Oh.
He was Daddy Warbucks for decades.
He's
played that on Broadway and tours and all over the place.
Oh, okay.
His first job was on the NET or Net Playhouse was the name of the series. I think Rene Auberjonois was also on this. It was a show, an anthology show, very much like Twilight Zone. Like they would adapt books or science fiction, things like that. So I don't know which episode he was in, but it was in 1969. His first job was on Net Playhouse.
Net Playhouse. Okay, great.
He was also in two of the last Star Trek, original Star Trek films, and he appeared on three different Star Trek series. But the most interesting thing I found out about John Shuck, he was married to Susan Bay from 1976 to 1983. Okay. They got divorced. Susan became Susan Nimoy, married Leonard Nimoy. So John Shuck's ex-wife,
became Leonard Nimoy's wife.
Leonard Nimoy's wife. Isn't that crazy?
That is crazy.
A lot of Star Trek connections for John Shuck, chorus number two. He was the tallest one, I think.
The tallest chorus. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Who else? Chorus number three is Tony Amendola. Tony Amendola.
We know Tony Amendola.
We know Tony
great. I thought that was him. I was like, isn't that Tony? Oh my goodness. Yeah.
Yes. His first job on film or television was Partners in Crime, a TV show with Linda Carter and Lonnie Anderson.
Okay.
1984.
Yeah.
So Tony was chorus number three. He's the one at the end who sort of tried to save the show. Improving at
That's
the
right.
end.
That
was Tony.
Tony also in his in the early part of his career played mostly heavy guy, you know, the bad guy, I think.
Yeah.
So, and it's funny because if you ever meet Tony and talk to him, he's the exact opposite of that in real life.
He's
so.
The nicest guy.
Super nice.
Great guy. We had Michael Houston King as Jero. He was the actor that sort of played the Tom Paris character in the company.
And
other roles, too. They all played multiple roles. But his debut was in 1996 on the soap opera Another World.
So not too long before Voyager.
Not too long. We had Kathleen Garrett, another actress in the company, played Tannis.
Right.
Now, Kathleen Garrett, her debut was in 1982. A TV show called For Lovers Only, and it starred Andy Griffith.
Oh.
It might have been a TV movie, actually.
Yeah, okay.
But it was Andy Griffith, 1982, For Lovers Only. Here's the interesting thing about Kathleen Garrett.
Yes.
She did Robert Beltran's production of Hamlet. She was in that.
Which I went to see. I don't know if you went to see it, but I
did go
see it.
Everyone was great, but I don't specifically remember her, but she was in Robert's production in 1997 of Hamlet. She played Queen Gertrude.
Nice.
Got great reviews in that from what I could see. And I was just amazed. She
Do you recall when Beltran came to he made the announcement. He said, guys, I'm going to be doing Hamlet and reprising Hamlet in West Hollywood or whatever, 99-seat theater. All of us were like, oh, because we were all nervous for him because, you know,
he can't remember his lines.
He can't remember his lines
on
Voyager to save his life.
How's he going
to
learn Hamlet?
How is he going to learn Shakespeare? How will he remember Shakespeare and not go up on his lines? And the funny thing is, when he performed Shakespeare, which he loves that genre.
Yes, he does.
It flowed out of him like it was just butter. All of those lines came out. He never messed anything up, which was, thank goodness, you know, it was good.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyone else?
Very, very last one that I saw was the warlord, the patron guy.
Right.
Stoney Westmoreland was
the guy
name.
That reminds me of Andy Richter, the sidekick on the Tonight Show of one of the night evening shows, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Stoney Westmoreland was in the sitcom Townies in 1996.
Ah.
Which I think I think like Ron Livingston was in that.
Okay.
I can't remember who else.
All right. So the very first scene, we're basically at an outdoor amphitheater. That's what it looks like. And you hear a captain's log, and it's sort of chanted almost Borg-like in a way. Captain's log, star date 53896, Balana Torres requests permission to search for dilithium. So we're listening to all these lines and we're wondering, what is this exact? Well, I knew because I remember this episode, but when you're watching this for the first time, you have no clue what's happening. Young Carrie Kim in an escape pod, and there's Kellis the poet. This is the first time we realize that there's somebody writing about the Voyager characters.
Yeah.
And he refers to them as the Voyager Eternals. So this is almost something from their own
mythology or religion,
their own lore, exactly, where there are these beings known as the Eternals. They're very powerful, and so he calls the Voyagers, the Voyager cast, Eternals as well, the Voyager Eternals.
It felt like this Greek chorus that was reciting this story.
It was very much the Greek chorus. That's what it sounded like.
It felt like they were comparing or calling Voyager like a sailing ship, you know what I mean?
There was
references to like cast against the rocks,
right,
things like
because
that.
Because they're a pre-warp society, so they're not going to understand warp cores and all this stuff. So they're still sort of developing. And after the end of this play, and it's actually not that long, all the audience is very excited. They're very happy to see this. And the patron, or let's just call him the duke or the king of that area, that territory. Yeah. What do you want to call him? That guy.
I think he was the warlord.
He called him the patron, is what he said.
He kept calling him the patron, but he also was like a fighter. Like there was a lot of worry about.
Let's say the warlord. From now on, let's refer to him as the warlord.
Okay.
So the warlord is there with his warlordess, his wife, whoever that is. And he wants the next version. He wants the next edition of this play to come out in a week. And from this scene, we know that he's very insistent. He's persistent he's a tough guy. He's a powerful guy. Yes. And he's dressed in all his regalia. He's kind of blinged out.
Did you see the guards beside him with their
yes.
Yeah. They're
massive. Yeah.
Headpieces or something. That was very cool.
But still kind of Greek era type of
totally Greek
armor and headpieces. Yeah. But Kellis does ask if his patron has noticed how thin his performers have become. So sort of a side way of saying, hey, we would love to have a little bit of extra, little moolah here. And this was the funny part of this scene. The warlord reaches what seems
to his
like
wife or girlfriend or whatever.
Cleavage or something. I mean, he just reaches in and he pulls something out as if, I mean,
where I thought it was a necklace. No,
the thing? Okay, because I thought it was just a gemstone that he pulled out of a pocket, her front pocket or something. It was very
I think it was a neck weird. On a necklace, and I thought he just like yanked it and broke the chain.
Well, that makes more sense. I mean, the other way is just like, what's happening? But evidently, it's a very valuable piece of necklace or whatever it is. Throws it over at young Kellis, and he's like, great, we got food money now. So
yeah, exactly. This was a big set, by the way.
Yes.
I was really impressed with our art department and the set designers, and because it was a theater, it was an amphitheater.
Yeah,
I mean, there weren't hundreds of people. There was, you know, maybe 50, 60 people or something.
So you think that was on 16, or do you think they put it on?
Yeah,
9?
I think it was on 16.
Okay,
I think it was over by the cave sets because it felt like they kind of built it into that cave. You know, that open area where the caves kind of opened up to the two level cave.
Yeah, over
they could have built it somewhere over near there.
Yeah.
So that when they went backstage, they could kind of go in that open area of the caves. Maybe that's what I was picturing.
Yeah. And well, the only series regular that knows where that was for sure, it would be Roxanne.
Roxanne,
she's the only one that worked on that set. Everyone else was one of the guest cast. So
yeah.
But did you like the overall shots that they use and how
totally
they began?
Did. Yes. I think Mike did a great job in this episode.
Agreed.
It was really, really elegant and simple.
Yes.
But really well done.
Yes. And then we jump to the Delta Flyer at night where candles are lit everywhere. And this is interesting. We actually talked about this in the last episode about being lit by candles and things like that. We actually broached that subject as well. But it's very well, you know, it looks nice. It looks like it's all lit for a nice romantic dinner is what it looks like, but you can tell the Delta Flyer is in shambles. It is absolutely,
and it's like sideways.
It's sideways.
You know?
It's
usually,
tilted.
That Delta Flyer set piece is always on a platform. It's usually straight, but this time they must have angled it up and broken the glass and things like that.
Right.
So, actually, speaking of broken glass,
Yeah.
So the windows, you know, it's in a shambles. It's kind of dark. You can see like woods or trees outside the windows, but you could also see like broken shards where the glass of the windows,
or whatever. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was broken. And then I thought, didn't we always say that there was no glass there, that it was like,
that's just a force field, right?
A force field, right?
Yeah.
So why did they have broken glass in the Delta Flyer? It would have been a force field.
I think there's still some type of glass there.
Regardless. Something.
It doesn't make any sense to be just have holes sitting in your vessel, you know?
Maybe it's a backup, like a force. I don't know.
In case the force field. I mean, if you think about it, if your shields go down, if your shields are to zero, you're just going to get sucked into space. Am I right?
Yeah.
And wouldn't you
just
be sucked through there? So there has to be some type of really strong, clear. I think one of our fans told us that it was clear. It was see-through titanium is what it was, or something like that. You know, so it's actually a very strong ore, a strong metal, but they've engineered it so that it's actually clear that you can see through it. So that's what I understand, according to one of our fans. So hopefully that's what it is. But it looks like it's abandoned, though. You don't see any life there.
Anybody.
The way Mike Vahar shot that, he shot that very well. Yeah. And we do see someone, we do hear a little bit of rustling, and it's Kellis. It's our poet who showed up and he walks in there. And then we do have a reveal where you do see it's Torres, and she's bound.
Tied up. Yeah,
she's tied up, and she's got blood on her arm too. So
she's got all these, like, it looks like intentional cuts. Doesn't look like
damage injuries. From when she crashed. No, not at all. So when Kellis comes close to her, she does do a little bit of rambunctious fighting. I think she knocks him back a little bit, but it's now we know she is basically a prisoner of this poet. And
he said in the play, he goes, I rescued her.
Yeah.
So he does admit in that first play, that opening scene, that, that he found her on her ship and rescued her. Yeah. And he's got the inside connection. And now we realize, you didn't rescue her. You tied her up, and she's your prisoner.
Exactly. But we do find out that he learned a lot of these facts and details that he put into his play from from the logs within the Delta Flyer. Like, he could hear the sensor, he accessed the sensor logs, some audio files as so now he knew the predicament of how
he knew some of the story from what was on these logs. Exactly.
Yeah. The question is, it's not a question. I guess they imply that she's been unconscious this entire time, right? Because the whole thing with the cuts, it was an ancient form of bloodletting that he was doing to try to heal her in a way.
Yeah. She says something like, you're trying to,
you're trying to kill me. And he's
trying to kill me. And he goes, no, I'm trying to save you.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the only way to let out the evil spirits is bloodletting.
Yeah.
So, they're very primitive.
She says, like, untie me all throughout the scene. He's like, no, you can't do it. But finally she does tell him, look, there's a medical kit, which then she has to say a box, a metallic box, because he doesn't know what a medical kit is. But he brings over a device, which is basically a dermal regenerator is what it is. And he asks, she turns it on, and then he jumps back a little bit, and she says, no, don't worry, this is going to help me. I want you to run this over my wound, which she does, and miraculously he's like,
my God,
you are an
miracle.
Yes. Unbelievable. Yes. Yeah.
What other kind of miracles can you do? He's very impressed.
He is impressed.
Yeah. She does ask how long she's been there. And he says 8 days.
Mm-hmm.
So we know she's been there 8 days unconscious.
Yeah.
And he said he got this one play from the logs, but he needs more stories of the Voyager Eternals.
Yeah.
And so they basically make this deal. It's like, she goes, we Eternals have our rules. We can't just give things away for free.
Right.
So cut me loose and I'll tell you more stories. And she convinces him to release her. And then she grabs a phaser.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah, that's right. Says, she repels him. Yeah.
Get out of here.
Get out of here. Don't ever come back again.
Don't ever come back. And she actually shoots out the broken window.
She shoots a branch.
She shoots a tree that vaporizes so that he can see what this thing will do.
You know, that bummed me out. I was like, that tree did not deserve it.
No.
It could have been a rock. He should have shot a rock or the dirt, but the tree is still living. And that kind of That bummed me out a little bit.
Just I'm still stuck on the broken windows. It doesn't make any sense.
Okay, fine.
That she can shoot out a window. But anyway.
So he runs away. He scurries away. And then later there's a passage of time. It is now daytime. And we're back in the Delta Flyer interior. All of a sudden, we hear Kellis. He's back. He's got food now. And, you know, Torres doesn't turn that down. She's starving at this point.
Yeah.
I don't think anything on that Delta Flyer is even working at this point, replicators or anything. So she starts nibbling. And basically, he starts asking her for more information about
especially about Earth.
Wants to know this and that. Yeah, so he's getting more details for his next play that he needs to write.
But you can see, you can see that she knows he's a poet and he wants like the poetic version.
Yes,
so she goes, it's a beautiful blue and green
island.
Planet,
yeah,
like an island.
She didn't say planet. She says
doesn't say planet. Yeah, she pauses.
She's not gonna get that. Yeah,
yeah, like an island.
Yeah, yeah. So she kind of goes with the flow on this one, which is very smart of her. All the way until he asks about, is she in love? Are you in love with Tom Paris? And that ends the conversation for some reason.
She's like,
reason.
Supper is over. Yeah. Why didn't she say yes?
I don't think she's very proud to be with you with that.
I don't
like
either.
That was very disturbing. Either. Okay.
I agree.
All
with
the PT
you.
Shippers out there are probably feeling queasy. Their stomach is just turning upside down. What is happening here? Why would you say that?
It was very confusing that she shut down the conversation.
She shut it down completely.
When he brought up Tom Paris.
Brick wall, okay?
And later when we see Tom, by the way, Tom's like distraught. He's so
distraught,
upset.
But let's talk about that when we get there. So she takes him to the back section. She's like, come on, Kellis. Let's not talk about Tom Paris. And she activates, I guess there's enough power to activate one display with a computer kind of pops on. And then she shows him a graphic of, I guess, what dilithium looks like. I don't think we've ever seen that before until this, this episode.
It looked like crystals you get at like the hippie, crystal shop.
At the Psychic Eye bookstore.
Yes,
exactly. It was like, can I have that crystal, please? So, well, he recognizes it immediately. He calls it Winter's Tears, which is quite poetic of Banofsky to call them Winter's Tears. And then we find out that it's located in one area on the patron's hunting grounds, which is completely illegal for anybody other than the patron to go wander around and, collect things. And he's like, no, we can't. There's no way. And she's like, okay, well, this is the only way that I can tell you more information for your play. You need
no
to
more stories
this.
For you. Yeah. That's right.
Until you get this dilithium, this Winter's Tears for me. You need to bring that back. A storm does begin.
And by the way, he brings up this idea that the patron and other nobles of his planet, or civilization, they're always at war. Like they're fighting. There's a lot of conflict.
All the time.
And that's when she says, she kind of backs down. She doesn't want to start a war. So she's like, okay. She sort of backs down a little.
That's right.
But then there's a thunderclap outside. Do you remember like a lightning or something?
Yeah. And it was timed perfectly because it almost seemed like she had caused it. Because he's like, what? Did you do that?
Did you do that? And she goes, basically, yep.
Yeah.
Don't get caught.
Yeah. By not saying anything, then he basically was thinking she did it. Yeah. Don't get caught. So he runs off to go retrieve the dilithium. Yep. And back to the Delta Flyer interior, still a more passage of time. Now the storming is still continuing. It's
Soaking wet.
He's soaking wet when he returns.
Do you remember when you had to do scenes when you were supposed to be wet? It was the most uncomfortable thing because they'd
horrible.
Have to spray down your
it's
costume.
The worst, yeah.
And you're just freezing.
Because they're not really spraying warm water on you, are they? They're just spraying water, which is, freezing already,
and you're in it for a long time.
We
shoot these scenes for hours, and so you're just in wet clothes, and I felt so bad for him coming back.
I know. I mean, if you think about it, that scene when he comes back is what, I don't know, 2 minutes. So anyone watching is thinking, he was wet for 2 minutes.
No,
he was wet for
hour upon hour.
Just for that segment right there. Torres basically says that she has an idea for his next play. And and the other thing about this episode that I liked is I like the transitions from one scene to the next. They almost led organically to the next one, right?
It was very well structured by Joe and really well done by Mike Vahar. In the scene when he comes back all wet, he does bring back the dilithium. So now
he has it. Yeah, so she's
got it. We see these crystals from the Psychic Eye bookstore.
Yes.
which is probably where the props department got them.
Hopefully they took the price tag off of it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's not still sitting on there.
It's very okay. Nice display of crystals. It would look really lovely in my house.
Most definitely on an end table, coffee table. Yeah. All right. So after she says, I have an idea for your next play. Yeah. We segue the amphitheater. We're back to the amphitheater. Kellis arrives very excited, and he says that he has been visited by inspiration herself. So clearly inspiration is a female in his eyes. And he says, I have the new play. It's called The Rescue of B'Elanna Torres.
Yeah. And when he comes back, by the way, he runs down this tunnel onto the stage, you know, the stage area. And the actors are all just hanging out.
Yeah.
And I was like, what are they doing? Shouldn't they be rehearsing something or doing a dance class or whatever actors do? I don't know.
My feeling was that they lived there. Like that was also where they lived.
And the actors lived. Yeah. Can you imagine if we lived at stage
theater?
Nine?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Stage nine. No, that would be horrible.
If when we, for 7 years while we did Voyager, we had to live there.
Oh my gosh. I would, I couldn't do that.
No. I mean, it's nice, but I know.
No, you can't live on 7. I would wait a minute. I would not live on 16. I would live on 8 and 9. I can live in my quarters quite easily. I could. I mean, those are nice quarters, and there's no feral cats and, you know, cat feces.
If we had to live there and the replicators in the holodeck actually worked, I'd totally live there then.
Would you?
But they didn't. It was not real. So
no, it really wasn't.
I can't replicate stuff. I can't play around in the holodeck.
No.
Nah,
but Amazon's pretty close to replicating something. I mean, you could order the same day and get it pretty quickly.
True.
Am I right? Okay. All righty. So The Rescue of B'Elanna Torres. That's the new play. He's very, very excited.
Let's get to work. Other? He's like, let's go. We'll start rehearsing. So we don't know what story she told him, but he's got another idea.
He's ready to go. Okay. So we're moving on. We have an exterior space shot of Voyager
flyby
space. Yeah. Nice flyby. Nice flyby. And then we're in the briefing room with Janeway. And we come in. It's interesting. We never come in at the very end of the briefing room scene. Basically, she says dismissed. Like that's the top of the scene. Okay. And Tom gets up and he's protesting. He's like, no, this is not the only way. There's got to be something. I want to take a shuttle. I want to take that shuttle and go planet by planet. I'm going to search every single planet. And, you know, Chakotay is like, no, that's too dangerous. The spatial eddies that knock the flyer off the course, you will possibly encounter those same spatial eddies.
Yep.
And now you're going to be crash landing on some planet. And I just like the very end, how everyone leaves except for Paris. Yeah. And that's typically what we see with Harry. Harry's always the last one in the briefing room and he sits down and is very pensive. But in this episode, it's Tom. And do you remember that scene at all?
I don't remember it, but I did notice that in this scene, and there's another scene where Mike Fahar shot, instead of from the inside looking towards the windows and out to space, he shot from out in space, outside the set, through the window.
Yeah.
And he did it a couple times in this episode. And that was an interesting change in pattern that we normally did.
Yeah.
The other thing I noticed in this scene, so you had Neelix there, you had the Doctor there, you had Tuvok there.
Yeah.
You had Seven of Nine, Chakotay. Right. Everybody's there.
They're all there.
But the only people that spoke were me, Janeway, Chakotay, and Seven had one line.
Which is a little weird. Which is
weird.
Usually everyone has a line or two in that briefing.
Neelix didn't have a line. The Doctor didn't have a line. Tuvok, they had no lines, which is, I hated when that happened.
Oh, yeah. All the actors that had no lines were not happy that day. I'm going to tell you right now. They're sitting there going, really? You could not have written my character out of this scene? I have nothing to say here. And usually the writers were good like that. If we had nothing to say, they wouldn't even have us there. They'd let us have the day off, but not here.
Did you notice when Janeway comes over to Paris that she touches his shoulder?
Yeah, she does.
He looks down at her hand and they have this long pause. I was just thinking.
Were you thinking about salamanders?
There's still something little salamander connection, and Janeway might be thinking, "Well, B'Elanna's gone, Tom." You know what I mean?
Exactly. We can be Mr. and Mrs. Salamander. So
I felt like that moment had a lot of subtext in it.
It did, and you could have threw a monkey wrench in there. As she put her hand on your shoulder, if you kind of like reached over and kissed her hand, that would have been
a whole different story.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, but we didn't go down that road. But
no, we didn't.
It was a nice moment of
but
touching.
It's still very rare to see a heavy moment with Paris like that. Like, yeah. I mean, obviously when you did the episode Threshold where you had salamander babies, that was heavy. That was very heavy, but
dramatic,
here,
but yeah, this it's dramatic. Is just sad. Yeah, it's
sad and heavy. I'm just saying to see Paris sit down and be so just distraught and
dropped
out of it.
Head.
Yeah, dropping his head and he's
feeling
like...
That's how emotional Paris was. But Torres clearly wasn't very emotional when the guy said, are you in love with Paris? Clearly she didn't have the same feelings at that point.
Okay,
so
the flip side of the coin is she just doesn't want to air her... Not air her dirty laundry, but she wants to keep her private life private. That's the other
thing. I know, I thought of that too. She might be protecting... herself, and you know, maybe they're gonna try to leverage my love or my emotional
something
life,
so like that. She doesn't know what's gonna happen. Yeah, she's not gonna show her hand. So, okay, that's how we'll validate that. All right, good.
Okay, fine.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So now we're back in the amphitheater and they're in the midst of rehearsal and the old man and the chorus are exclaiming, steady armed Paris bound by a sleep that brings no rest, which is great because look, you were totally in that other scene, totally alone. And now they're going right into it. A nice transition.
Yeah.
And Paris basically says, unpleasant news delivered by the most pleasing of messengers. And then he kisses the actress playing Seven of Nine, which was so bizarre to see that Paris would be kissing Seven. And Kellis is very frustrated with his performers. He's like, what are you doing? You can't, you know, he's not happy because he feels like they don't get the Eternals, the Voyager Eternals.
Also, she doesn't, the actress didn't want to go over close, you know, near Paris when he's lying down there. So she gives her lines and then the director, Kellis, says closer.
And then
she steps a little closer and he goes closer.
Yeah.
So it was very funny. Her look of like, I don't want to be doing this love scene.
No, because she's in love with Kellis, right? I mean, yeah. So that's another thing. She was not happy about that.
And Kellis is so frustrated. He gets up and he throws his script. Do you remember that at the end? He threw his script.
No,
he had his pages there and he like threw it. I thought, oh, what a classic director move. I like that little detail.
You like that detail.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah,
okay. Now we're moving on. We're back in the Delta Flyer interior. Kellis is pacing back and forth behind B'Elanna. Kellis says that he cannot blame his performers who are having difficulty understanding the Eternals on Voyager. And then he starts mumbling a little bit more about what's going on. And he starts bringing up how he doesn't understand how it's possible that Tuvok has no emotions, which is actually funny because they don't know what Vulcans are, right?
Yeah.
And during this conversation, as he's talking, B'Elanna does get the power up and running. She's connected to dilithium, so she has some power now. Mm-hmm. And her goal is to get this subspace transmitter online to get a message to Voyager. So as she's trying to bring this transmitter online, it does overload. So it fritzes out and kind of, you know, explodes basically.
Explodes, it was a nice big
loud
pop.
Bang. And she's frustrated, but she does turn to Kellis and say, what type of alloys do you have here? And ultimately she tells Kellis, I need a thin plate of metal that is comprised of 3 parts tin, 5 parts bronze, with one side coated with gold. And Kellis is like, gold, that's expensive. I can't get it. She's like, well, I guess you're going to be in debt then. And she says, the plate in exchange for information on Vulcans.
Vulcans.
Tuvok.
He keeps asking about Vulcans. He's obsessed with, he doesn't understand Vulcans. So he's like, all right, I'll do it. I can't do it now because everybody's sleeping, but I'll do it in the morning if you tell me about Vulcans.
Right.
Yeah. So off of that moment,
Yeah.
We go into the mess hall.
Which is awesome. Another great transition. Yeah. Low light in there. Tuvok's there's kind of in a profile shot there. And Neelix mm-hmm. walks up and says, by his count, he hasn't slept in 10 days. Tuvok does affirm that. He says, yes, it's been a while. But he also says that Vulcans don't need sleep for 2 weeks. And I thought, wow, that's kind of amazing. But, you know, Neelix is like, you might think about the fact that this might be a point of diminishing returns where you're so tired that everything you're doing right now is you're kind of running your wheels. You're spinning your wheels and going nowhere right now. So, but Tuvok says, nope, he's fine.
I did like that Neelix says, you know, the ship is lonely without Kim.
Oh, yes.
Which I thought was a really sweet
gesture. That was a sweet moment. Yes.
And I think Tuvok was feeling that as well. It's just the Vulcan way he was dealing with it. That's why he was so obsessed and not sleeping.
He didn't want to go to sleep because he was trying to find a way to find us, right? So trying to find Harry and B'Elanna. Yeah.
The other thing I noticed in the scene was
the lighting.
Tuvok was there, a couple people. Yeah, it was a little lower lighting.
Yeah.
But there was a bowl of nuts on the table. And all of a sudden I remembered, I was like, oh my God. Yeah. We always had those silver bowls
with on nuts in them.
With nuts. I'm like, what is this, a cocktail lounge? Like, and by the way, you never eat the nuts in the bowl.
No, you don't touch the nuts.
They've been there forever. They're probably dusty and grimy.
I'm going to say that those nuts were there since TNG was there. So don't touch the nuts.
Touch the nuts.
No.
But what? It's a cocktail lounge, basically, is what I'm
clearly
saying.
Ten forward. Okay, so now we go back to the amphitheater. They're back into rehearsal again, and the actor that's it being focused on is the actor playing the role of Tuvok, basically.
Yeah, playing Tuvok,
and then
he's getting emotional.
He got emotional. He starts crying. very funny.
Kellis is very upset. He yells at him. He says Tuvok is logical. He wouldn't cry. What are you doing?
Yeah, but I mean, I love Kellis, how the actor's like, you know what? But if I do it this way, they're either going to think that Tuvok is a monster or that I'm a bad actor because I have no emotion. Right. And he's like, no, he has no emotion because that's the way it is. And so this is just very difficult for the actor to understand.
I like when Kellis also says, in the land of Vulcan, there is no laughter.
Yes, there is no laughter. Yeah,
so it's not planets. This is a great... There are oceans and ships and islands, but there's no planets. They can't go there yet.
Yeah. Amidst this this whole talk about the land of Vulcan, a messenger does arrive saying that their patron, their warlord, has been insulted by his enemy to the north. The armories have been opened. Kellis quickly asks, has the battlefield been chosen? Which in this land or this time, this planet, that's a big deal. And so if it hasn't been chosen, then basically hostilities haven't truly begun. So
yeah, if they haven't chosen the battlefield, I got some time to get
Kellis,
this new play
that's
done.
That's right. Kellis says, then I have time. And well, it's sort of, it's a little vague because you don't know. He didn't say, he just says, then I have time. But later we learn time, meaning he can get another play going to sort of change the mind of his warlord.
Yeah.
So we're back in the Delta Flyer interior and Kellis tells B'Elanna that he really needs help. He needs help.
He brings the metal, by the way. He does have the metal.
Yeah, but it has impurities in it, so it's not really the best metal to use. It's not going to hold a Polaron charge, I think is what she said.
Yeah.
Something like that. But he really needs help to help change his patron's mind, the warlord's mind about going to battle. And he thinks that his play is the way to stop this battle from happening, this war from happening. And he basically convinces B'Elanna to come with him to show her what he's developed so far, what he's written so far in this play.
First, she says, you know, Eternals shouldn't get involved in these
kind
of disputes.
That's right. She does.
And he goes,
that.
Well, you may not want to get involved, but if you stay here, you're going to be discovered.
Yeah.
You know, there's scouting parties heading this way. And if you get discovered, that's the end of all of this. So that's what sort of makes her listen. And she goes to help him write the play.
Yeah. So we end up back at the amphitheater and he's got to introduce her clearly to everyone there. So he comes up with this story that this is a fellow poet.
And she's in a robe, by the way. She's like in a monk's robe.
She's in a robe. Yeah, so she's covered up, but everyone can see her. Her forehead is definitely not that
different.
That little, you know, round oblong, you know,
like
whatever
them.
They, like them. So he says she's a fellow poet from across the Eastern Sea and that she's an expert on Voyager. and the Voyager Eternals. And right when he says that, his girlfriend leaves.
She's so mad. Oh, you see her in the background. Mad. Like she's fuming.
No, she immediately, because she knows how jazzed and how passionate that Kellis is. And she can see that he's passionate about introducing B'Elanna, which immediately she feels that they're having some type of side nookie right now.
And B'Elanna notices that, by the way.
Yeah, she does see that.
She sees her storm off.
She does see that. And then I wrote, then they kind of move in. They're not on the amphitheater. They move into what I wrote as the amphitheater backstage area.
Yeah, I call it backstage.
The workshop.
Exactly.
Yeah, whatever that is.
That's where I think was in our cave set, kind of off in that open corner area.
Oh,
I think they built the backstage in that area.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah. The rescue of B'Elanna Torres. They work on the play. Kellis asks, where is the mistaken identity, the discovery? The sudden reversal. So now we get a little glimpse of the parallels of a Hollywood television writer.
This is where he's talking about the plot twist, the discovery, the sudden reversals, all that stuff you mentioned. Those are writer issues.
Yeah, those are writer issues.
This is like a biography of Joe Manosky's career. Like
pretty much.
I've got to come up with a script.
Can you give the appropriate Joseph Campbell. Does Joseph Campbell talk about things like mistaken identity, the discovery, and sudden reversal
classic,
as well?
I think those are classic kind of Greek tragedy or Greek drama, tools that were used in the stories. They always had the deus ex machina, the gods coming in at the end or something. So I think Joe, who's loves the classics, he loves things that are ancient and old, Roman history, Greek history, mythology, things like that. I think that's where he was not only talking about being a TV writer and needing to have those parts of his story, but that's the kind of stuff that Joe loves.
Yeah,
he loves
most definitely. So it's at this point that our senior most chorus member, Mr. Axelrod, comes into the scene, and he talks about, you just need to find the truth of the story. You don't have to rely on these tricks. So basically he's saying, look, in the old days, they didn't need these mistaken identity or the discovery or the sudden reversal. You just have to find the truth of the story. That's it. And I just love that now we have a little bit of a JC Shipper moment, because we do see, I think they rehearse the kiss at this point, don't they?
Yes, they do.
Oh my goodness.
Yes. Janeway and Chakotay have masks. It's a Janeway and Chakotay scene. So the actors playing them have the masks.
The masks look pretty authentic too. They look close to
the masks were very cool.
Yep.
And then they touch the mask and the masks come down together.
And then they share a kiss.
And then the Janeway character says something like, I've been denied the privilege of your touch.
Yeah.
Or something very poetic.
Most definitely poetic and romantic.
Kiss. And then you see Torres kind of sitting in the audience. She's like shocked.
Oh, yeah.
This is not what really happens.
She's not. No, definitely not. We jump to the captain's ready room. And it's great because they go from the kiss again. Look at the transition right into Janeway's alone in the ready room. Chakotay shows up. So you're thinking, oh, maybe something's going to happen, but
they're going to have a kiss. Yeah. The transition is even made better because she's kind of lounging and looking out the window. So off of that romantic kiss moment,
you have this
a romantic physical position. She's just like, yeah, it's really made better,
well done, though, right?
Yeah,
come on. Mike
well
Behar
done.
Did his homework on this one.
Yeah.
Chakotay does arrive to tell Janeway that an alien transport vessel has picked up the Delta Flyer's distress call. So this distress call was picked up about 10 days ago. Then Janeway does ask Chakotay, how long could Harry survive? And Chakotay says less than 10 days in that escape pod that he was in.
Yeah, hear the Fritzy distress call. You see B'Elanna. You hear B'Elanna. It's sort of broken up,
sent Harry.
The flyer's damaged, and she's headed for an L-class planet, and that she ordered Harry into an escape pod.
Right,
ordered him to eject.
Right,
yeah, and that was 10 days ago.
Yeah, and that the amount of time that Harry could survive is less than 10 days. So now we basically have the possibility that Harry's now dead, right?
Yep.
And you do have a very rare moment of emotion from Janeway after...
She's very distressed.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. The minute Chakotay leaves, she doesn't show Chakotay her emotion until... She doesn't, you know, let him in on this. But the minute he's gone, it comes out. It's almost like she sits there and thinks, great, you know, I possibly have lost my chief engineer and my operations and communications officer. They're gone, you know, and this is, and I felt that it was more Harry that she was thinking about because really, you know,
she felt
Janeway,
like a mother. Well,
Janeway met Harry's mom and dad and said, look, I'll get him back fine. So he's the youngest Starfleet senior officer. And this is a huge,
she was very emotional. Yeah.
Most definitely a huge responsibility for her that Harry, you know, was kind of in her charge in a way. And now there's a possibility that he's not alive any longer. So
you know what else was sad about the end of the scene is that Janeway and Chakotay didn't kiss like in the play. It was very sad, very emotional. I was sad.
Okay,
they should have kissed like the play. The play's got it right. Okay,
all right, the play has it right. Yeah, clearly. So now we're back at the amphitheater. It's nighttime. We have some cool quotes here. We hear that anger is like fire. Love can be the rain that extinguishes it. So poetic. So at this point, there's some questions about the Borg that Kellis asked B'Elanna. And this is kind of a turning point, because before he was talking about, okay, it has to be love. There has to be love. There has to be kissing between Janeway and Chakotay.
She's like, I can't believe you've got too much kissing in this play. Yes. Why is everybody kissing?
Everyone's kissing everyone else, right?
And and he says, no, that the theater started as a temple 100 years ago. He goes into some history here. He says, the theater was a temple, and where victims would be sacrificed in honor of winter every year.
Yeah.
But then one year, and nobody knows why they did this.
Yeah.
They didn't sacrifice an innocent human or person.
Mm-hmm.
They performed a play in place of it.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what I'm talking about. Like, Joe Manosky knows that's Greek history. That's the theater came out of religious practices.
Yeah.
So I love that he got some of that history into this story.
I do too. I think that's awesome. But this conversation with Tora is sort of, it's a brainstorming session. And so he realizes.
Do you remember, by the way, he says, we're going to have to do better than Harry kissing the Delaney sisters.
Oh yeah.
I was like, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with Harry kissing
the Delaney? I forgot about that.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. But this description of the Borg and how the Borg operate, they have a queen, they have soldiers that are part of this vast army. So this conversation sort of basically triggers Kellis to realize, like, oh, wait a minute, I do have a sudden reversal here. Okay, so Janeway could be holding her spears at the throat of the queen, and then instead of killing her at the end, she throws aside her weapon and says that she's going to make peace exactly. And so hopefully this is the message that his warlord will respond to, and hopefully not get into war with their northern enemy, which is the ultimate goal, to stay alive.
And Torres is like, that's much better than all that kissing.
Right.
So clearly B'Elanna hates romance and kissing, which I wish I had known is Tom Paris.
He still wants it. He still needs an ending.
He's like, I don't have an ending.
Yeah. Torres is like, no, you'll figure it out. You'll get it.
And he goes, you know what? He threatens to kill off her character.
He says,
what if B'Elanna Torres dies tragically?
Yeah, there you go.
Then she actually cares. She's like, you wouldn't dare.
But she's bonded with him. Like, look at that response to him. Like, you wouldn't dare. This is like buddies. Like, you. If I was Tom, I'm like, okay, who is this alien dude? Huh? Yeah. Who is this alien guy bonding with my wife?
And by the way, killing off character. Like, that's what the TV writers think about all the time. Like, we could kill off this character.
Kill this person
we could
off.
Kill that one off. That'd be a dramatic turn. You'd never expect it.
Oh my gosh.
I think that was a little, I think there were some like, messages to our cast in this episode, like some subtle hinted at messages. All right, so next we have a planet shot, and you see the flyer crashed up on a hill, which I love. I thought those visits
that was a great shot.
Great.
I like that. Yeah,
really good shot. Mm-hmm. Then we go inside the flyer. Taurus comes in, And then it's revealed that Lena is there.
Yeah.
She's in the shadows. And I love the way that he sort of revealed her back there. And she basically says like she was expecting to find a love nest, but instead she's found out the secret that Torres is not an Eternal.
Yeah.
And Torres is like, there's nothing going, like, I get that you're jealous. Nothing going on with me and Kellis.
Oh, yeah.
Relax. But Lena doesn't believe her and says
she threatens her.
She does. She's like, I will expose you. You're not an Eternal.
Yeah.
And I'll tell everybody.
If you ever come back, right? Isn't that what she says? Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You need to leave.
Yeah.
Just don't come back.
Fix your ship and get out of here.
Exactly.
Don't talk to my boyfriend anymore. That's my boyfriend.
Exactly. Then she takes off.
Yeah.
And B'Elanna's like, oh, what are we going to do? And all of a sudden you hear Harry's voice.
Yeah.
And he's in the bushes.
Yes.
He appears right outside in the bushes and he's okay. He didn't die.
I was a little worried. I was like, where is Harry? Because remember when we were
never showing up.
My memory was that I was always in the shuttle, but injured. But that's not what happened.
No,
I was gone. I was not.
You
even
weren't even
close.
Injured.
I wasn't you even injured. I was totally fine. Yeah.
Although you were tired because you say like I walked 200 kilometers.
That's far. Think about that.
Yes.
Isn't that like the distance between, isn't that LA to Vegas or something like that?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a long ways to walk that far.
But he said he walked 200 kilometers and he carried, and he's got the piece that she needs.
Yeah, I do. But Harry did not walk during the day. He hid during the day. So that's another thing. He only walked during night, but he does save the day. He has exactly what they need in order to contact Voyager. So that escape pod transmitter that he has is basically gold to Torres. She's happy.
You know what else was cool in this scene is She reacted to Harry coming in, but at the very end when she leaves, and you're kind of in the back of the shuttle in the shadows, there's a nice moment holding on Harry and you found your eye light. Did you notice that? You were kind of in the shadows.
Yeah.
And then as she left, you kind of ducked down and
I pulled down to find the light. Yeah.
To find the light on your face. Very professional. Very nice move.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. But I did like her reaction to seeing Harry because it was very, very emotional and excited. And, you know, Torres doesn't get like that. You know what I'm saying? She's pretty by the book and really kind of not that person who's going to get excited like a schoolgirl. And she really did. She was like, Harry. So I really love the way that Roxanne Plourde portrayed moment, how she played that moment. I think it was very good.
We go to this high wide shot of the theater.
Yeah.
And like a VisFX shot.
Yeah.
And in this moment, I was like, and you see the village behind them.
Yeah.
In this moment, I was like, I wish they had done this a little different because you could see how tiny this theater was.
How would you have done it?
Literally had two rows of seating. And I was like, I would have turned it around so you saw more of the stage and less of how small the theater was itself.
Yes,
it felt like you were seeing that there was not much room for an audience. But anyway, our two row theater, our little off Broadway theater. We jump down, cut out of that wide shot, that VisFX shot, down inside the theater, and Kellis is there. He's pacing. He's trying to figure out the ending, and then
He's also wondering where B'Elanna is because he expected B'Elanna would be there, right?
Yeah.
So
And Lena comes in and she says, "You know, your collaborator is probably long gone. She's out of here. She's not coming back."
Right.
And I love when the older actor says something like, "Well, do you have an ending yet?" And he's like, "Not yet. Yeah. Soon, though. Soon." And the older actor's like, "Well, we better get it quickly because we're not going to have time to learn our lines."
Right.
And I was like, "Oh my God, that sounds like our cast. When are we going to get the script for the new episode? Because it starts shooting tomorrow."
Yeah.
And I remember Kate would always be like, "We're going to do bridge scenes tomorrow.
I know.
And I need to learn my lines."
Yeah.
Very funny. Late scripts. Very funny.
Oh yeah.
Anyway, so we go to another wide shuttle shot. We see the crash shuttle. We go inside. Yeah. There's Kim and Torres. They've been working, trying to get this communication system back online.
Yeah.
And I think B'Elanna says something like, "Okay, well, let's try again. The 38th time might be the charm."
So
they've been trying a lot.
Yeah. And it works.
And it works.
The 38th time. Yes. 38th time. Yep.
And then Harry says, after they get up working, he goes, "You do the honors."
Yeah. B'Elanna. You contact. Yeah.
You contact them. So they send this you know, message. She's going to send a message to
Voyager.
But
you only hear the first part. She just begins, Voyager, this is the Delta Flyer. And then we don't
and
hear
that's
the rest
it.
Of it until later.
She's going to send this.
Yep.
And then we go back to the theater, but now it's nighttime. This is the deadline. He's got to have this play written. So we don't know what
he
did.
The audience is there. The warlord is already in he's sitting in one of the two rows, the front of the first row.
Yeah, and he's there.
Yeah, he's not in a good mood. They're backstage looking out the curtain or whatever, right?
And the actors are not happy with the ending, by the way.
No.
They're like, this is not good.
No, it doesn't make sense,
Doesn't make sense, And so Kellis decides, one last thing, he's going to send a copy of it to B'Elanna. So he asks one of the, like, they've got people copying down the script that he wrote. They're copying, making copies for the other actors, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And he grabs one of them and says, take this new version and take it with a message to B'Elanna.
Yeah. Well, actually, he doesn't say to B'Elanna. He just says, you know where the ridge ends just below the peak?
Right.
Yeah. Run there as fast as you can and you'll find a vessel wrecked against the rocks. So that's his way of telling
basically
him.
Basically tells him where to go
and
send this message with the script to B'Elanna.
Don't be frightened when you see technology you don't know of. Yeah, basically.
And then we have a space flyby Voyager and we cut to the bridge. I love this scene.
Oh, my God. This scene was so funny.
So funny.
I love this scene.
We see Paris in kind of a close-up down there flying and
doing his thing.
Doing
his
thing, just kind of, you know, at ease or whatever. And suddenly there's a noise. And Paris, like, he's got a look on his face.
Yeah.
And there's another noise. And slowly Paris turns around. And Tuvok in the captain's chair is sitting straight up with his eyes closed, dead asleep, snoring.
Snoring.
And I loved this non-dialogue back and forth, the way they cut it, the moments. Because my face, the faces I made and reactions and like all these different snores.
Yeah.
And then his deadpan sort of the way he was sleeping was funny to me. It was just hilarious.
And how he woke up was hilarious too. Because you're like, Tuvok. And he's like, as you are. He wakes up he's still...
It was very funny. That whole, it was a classic comedic bit, but
it was really good. And comedy with you two, which is rare. You don't have comedy with Paris.
No, Paris and Tuvok are funny odd couple.
You are a funny couple.
Tuvok wakes up and he calls Chakotay and he's like, I need a break. I need some relief here.
He realizes.
And just at that moment, they get a transmission.
Yeah.
So
notification
Tom
sound. Yeah.
Tom goes to clear it up, but Tom gets out of the pilot seat.
Yeah. Why did you get up and why did you go there?
No idea.
You can do the same thing at con. I didn't understand why you got up.
I have no idea. And who's driving the ship at this point?
You put it on cruise control is what you did.
I guess so. You did. But it was confusing.
It is a little weird.
Yeah.
Why would you do that? Exactly. Yeah. Okay.
But Tom does clear up this, rough transmission, and it's B'Elanna. We realize that we're 5.2 light years away from the fourth planet near an F-type star. And so they set course for this planet at maximum.
Did you play relief at this point, or did you play excitement? What did you play when you heard that it was Harry?
I don't know. I felt like it played. I was still thinking about the comedic snoring bit before, so I was having the most fun with that part. The, B'Elanna calling, whatever.
You're like, whatever.
She doesn't love me anyway.
You don't know that. Nah. You don't know that, Tom Paris. Yeah. Okay.
But the snoring was funny. That was my favorite. That was my favorite thing I did in the whole episode was just the faces I made listening to him snore.
Oh, your little reaction faces.
My
there.
Mugging faces. Yeah.
But it worked well though. It was very good. That scene cut together quite well. But we do find out that Harry and B'Elanna are 5.2 light years away, F-type star, the fourth planet. So Tuvok is laying a course, maximum warp. What would have been funnier is if he gets that command out and just goes right back to sleep again. That would have been wonderful.
Yeah,
yes.
Good. We go to the theater next.
Yeah,
the play is, so this performance of the play that we don't know how it ends.
It's going on. It's happening.
It's going on. I love the crane shot that came in from behind the stage and then sort of wrapped around. Mm-hmm. Beautiful, big shot. I loved
it. Good job, Mike Vahar.
The characters of Captain Janeway and Seven of Nine are talking in the scene.
That's right.
And in the scene, they have found the Delta Flyer wrecked on a faraway shore.
Mm-hmm.
And the Janeway character tells the Seven character that Seven is the only one who can find B'Elanna.
Right.
And then Seven of Nine has a speech to the audience. She turns to the audience.
Yeah.
She talks about being queen of the Borg and how she's going to betray Janeway and take revenge on the Voyager.
Yeah. And no intention of finding B'Elanna Torres.
No intention. No. She's going to turn on him.
Yeah.
And then I love when she says to the audience, she tells the audience all of this, and then she says, say nothing.
But she also said, right before that, she's like, surprised. Like, she's almost like adding commentary to this. Like, and then say nothing, or you too, will be assimilated.
Yes, or you too will be assimilated. Like, they're
very interactive.
Like, the actors are going to assimilate the audience. But it was funny.
It was.
And
it was.
Then the Janeway character has a speech where she reveals to the audience that she knows
the plan is
happening. The Borg queen. And she says something like, my enemies are everywhere.
Yeah. And she also says, tell her nothing. Exactly.
Yes.
Or else she'll lose her advantage. So
that's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. Very funny.
Very funny scene.
Classic theater scene. Very funny.
Yeah.
We go back to the flyer. Harry and B'Elanna have reestablished communication with Voyager and they're giving their status. And Tom says, we don't see him, but he says, see you soon. And then suddenly this messenger.
Oh, the one from earlier. He shows
up. Yeah, he appears in the doorway and he's terrified. He's looking around this spaceship, the Delta Flyer, has never seen anything like it. Hands her Kellis's message and he's out. He's like, I'm out of here. And the message is basically threatening B'Elanna's character with death. I'm going to kill your character.
Right.
And he says he can't figure out the ending. And
Kim's like, who cares? He's like, whatever. Let's just. And then Torres is like, no, I do. And he's like, what? You're serious, B'Elanna? And she's like, yeah. Harry, have you ever inspired anybody? I like that line. And Kim's like, that's kind of a weird question. But you know, Torres has still got this bond with Kellis. She really does have this bond. And she's like, look, she realizes what's going on, that without her, he's dead in the water. And not only is he really going to be dead in the water, he could be killed by the warlord or the war, right? So one of those two things could happen. And so Kim is still confused. And basically, Torres says, tell the captain I'm going to be a little bit late because she has a mission to do. And she says, wait for my signal to Harry. So she beams out. And the transporter is now online because it's been fixed by Harry and Torres.
Yeah, so we go to the amphitheater next. And the play is in progress.
Mm-hmm.
And the Janeway and Janeway character has Seven on the ground with a spear.
At her neck.
About to kill
her.
Yes. And the Seven character tells Janeway that even if you kill me, the Borg will rise and, take your place and destroy you, Janeway.
Right.
And then Janeway thinks for a moment, throws the spear aside and tells Seven that if we continue this war, all of us will be destroyed and all that is left is hatred. And then Seven rises and says, fool, I'm free to attack again.
Yeah.
And Janeway goes again and again till we're all destroyed. So it's very dramatic anti-war sort of part of the play that Kellis has written. Then we go backstage and one of the actors tells Kellis that this final scene that you've written is going to ruin everything.
Yeah.
We should just improvise. And then suddenly Torres shows up.
Well, Kellis actually says it's too late to improvise. And that's when Torres goes, no, it's not.
Dun, 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 yeah, that's right.
She came to rescue. Kellis is excited. He's like, yeah, I knew you're going to be here. And Lena, horrible Lena, bad girlfriend. She's like, I told you not to show up. And Torres is like, no, hold on. And she runs. Lena runs out there to spill the beans, to be the tattletale, basically. Yeah.
Then I think the chorus in this part of the play, they say, finally, Voyager has reached our shores.
Right.
And B'Elanna then goes on the stage.
Right on stage. Yep.
And she starts acting in the play.
She did a really good job of being someone who's not really used to being in a play. You know, she kind of did it a little hesitant.
Yeah, exactly.
Good job. Good job. Good job, Roxanne.
She tells Kellis that he must say goodbye to the eternal B'Elanna Torres.
Yep.
Because she needs to return to the Eternals right before your eyes.
Yeah.
Which I kind of, now you kind of know, oh, she's going to do this, like,
going to do a beam out.
But just as you think she's going to do that and save the day, Lena runs out by the warlord and the whole audience and tells them that B'Elanna is...
Well, she's B'Elanna not an Eternal. Not, right? She's not from the Eastern Sea. And no. She's actually the real B'Elanna Torres. She said, I saw her ship. And lucky enough, chorus number one sort of plays into this and says,
exactly.
The lead actress, in a fit of jealousy, brands her rival an Eternal. Our patron rises to his feet to stop the play. And now the patron's like, oh, I love this. You almost got me.
I almost believed you.
Yeah. He goes, and he sits down, continue. And I love how they, the guards escort Lena away. They're like, we're taking you out of here.
The guards with the big
helmets.
Yeah, exactly. Big helmets on. It was amazing.
I think they should have taken the helmet off and stuck it on her is what they would have been. Another way to do it.
I like the helmets. The helmets are good helmets.
Yeah.
But Kellis, so the play continues. Kellis tells B'Elanna stay.
Yeah.
And Torres says goodbye. And Kellis says that, you'll inspire me every time I think of you. Mm-hmm. And I started thinking, B'Elanna is emotional in this moment. And so is Kellis. And I'm like, I'm kind of with Lena for a minute. I'm like, wait a minute. Is there why is this so personal? Why is she...
They bonded, man.
It felt a
they
little.
They bonded.
Didn't it feel a little romantic?
Yes.
The way that they were playing.
Oh,
this?
Yeah. And so it's now KT shippers, Kellis and Torres shippers,
I guess so. Mm-hmm. But she signals Voyager. She says, one to beam up.
Yeah.
And she.
Well, no, it wasn't Voyager. It was me.
Harry.
Yeah.
And says, one to beam up.
Mm-hmm.
And she disappears right on the stage.
Yeah.
And the audience is shocked. And then the chorus, I think, sort of ends the play.
Well, they say a couple of things. So ends the rescue of B'Elanna Torres, half Klingon, B'Elanna Torres, half human B'Elanna Torres, chief engineer. And then Kellis says the last words, which are, these stories will continue for as long as we have the breath to tell them. And as long as our patrons remain wise and compassionate, and Voyager will continue on her journey to the gleaming cities of Earth, where peace reigns and hatred has no home. And we end in a, don't we have a reaction of the warlord where he's like, oh, I will not go to battle. Sort of a realization.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So basically the job or the goal of them not getting into battle, it seems like it's implied they did not go to battle after
exactly.
This,
so. And in a way, I think it's Joe Manosky's way of saying like these kind of stories can really change people's lives. They can
most
change
definitely.
The way we look at the world. And
most
so,
definitely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was great.
Yep.
Fun episode.
I agree.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What is your lesson for this episode?
Lesson for me, it's kind of like a hodgepodge. Like with the old man coming in saying, what's important is the truth of the story. I mean, that was sort of one of my lessons. Like, you don't have to, more important than anything else is finding the truth in the situation if you're a writer. So that was like a lesson for writing specifically. Mm-hmm. But then I did like the whole thing where they said anger is like fire and love can be the rain that extinguishes it, which is true. I mean, if you approach mm-hmm. every situation from position of love, mm-hmm. how can anger survive, or how can anger continue if you're, because it takes two people to escalate it to a point where it becomes mm-hmm. It becomes mm-hmm. armed conflict. And so if one person is just giving love and not anger, it can never escalate to that point. So even though they obviously flipped it around the story a little bit, mm-hmm. there wasn't a lot of lovey-dovey in there, but still I do believe that was an important lesson as well.
Nice.
From this episode. Yeah.
Nice.
How about you?
I think for me, the fundamental lesson was that art can inspire change or teach valuable lessons. That art and whatever kind of art, music can have that effect. You know, visual arts, dance, TV shows, you know, they can actually inspire change and teach people something in the way that, like Joe talks about, the plays happened in a religious site where they used to sacrifice people,
right.
But instead of sacrificing them, they they started doing plays. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah. There's a sacred quality to art, I think.
Okay. What is your rating of this episode?
I really love this episode. I got to admit, I'm going to give it 8.2.
Oh, that's pretty good.
And the only reason that
why are you not higher? Yeah, that's my question.
I feel like there wasn't a lot of Janeway in this. There wasn't a lot of Neelix. There wasn't. It was missing, you know, some of the other cast. Yeah. But I just really like the episode was so strong to me. Mm. Our guest stars were all good. The story was good. Joe's writing was amazing. I really liked it. 8.2.
Okay, I'm gonna go a little higher than you. I'll go 8.4.
Holy moly.
Yeah, I'll go a little higher. Okay.
Wow.
What do we have from our admirals and captains?
Our admirals and captains average rating.
Yes, which we have not seen. Is
7.7.
Okay. All right.
So we were both a little higher, which is funny because I didn't have a lot to do in this episode.
Right.
A lot of the cast didn't. It was mostly B'Elanna and guest stars. And then you had the most of anybody. After that,
that's right.
Yeah. But it was just a great story. I think
the transitions between from scene to scene just they flowed so well. And again, the writing and the directing, you know, everything came together in this episode. I felt so. I really enjoyed it. All right. Well, that's it. Well, thank you, everyone. Thank you so much. Yeah, that's it. Thank you for joining us for this episode, talking and discussing the behind the scenes of the episode Muse, where. Basically, Robbie and I were not really there most of the time, but, you know, we do have our comments about this episode regardless. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And join us next week when Robbie and I will be discussing and recapping the episode Fury. Fury.
Fury.
Which has nothing to do with Nick Fury from the Marvel world. But
Good to know. Okay. Fury next week.
See you next week. Be there. All right. Patreon patrons, please stay tuned for your bonus material.